Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So the carnivore diet, from my opinion, is a diet that can sustain life. A vegan diet can sustain life, but it's not optimal.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Health Theory. Today we are joined by somebody who is going to make your brains leak out through your ears, the one and only Dom D'Agostino. Dom, welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Dude, I'm excited to have you back. The last time we talked about the brain and all the things around optimizing that, but this time I want to dive into like some really juicy stuff. So I heard you in a podcast say something that I've heard other people sort of dance around, but you really came out and said, we need to make this a prime time thing. We need to get everybody focused on, if you want to avoid getting sick in these very troubling times, then you need to you didn't say stay lean, but you said that the heavier people get, the more at risk they are, and they've got to know that, and they've got to get the weight down. And when you say weight, I assume you mean body fat. Why does that matter?
Well, I mean, it can mean body fat, but we're in interesting times, and with COVID, the main risk factor that's not really being discussed as much as it should be is metabolic health. I mean, that's why we have, you know, the conference, Metabolic Health Summit, which is bringing together clinicians and scientists and networkers to discuss this topic before COVID even hit. And we do know that if you have hyperinsulinemia, hyperglycemia, type 2 diabetes, if you're overweight, if you're obese, you're astronomically at a higher risk for contracting but having a poor outcome if you have COVID-19 infections, whether it be, you know, just your immune system or your atherogenic risk or your body's ability to cope. You know, if you have hyperglycemia and high inflammation, that's a burden that your body has to deal with in addition to the COVID infection. And that could also exacerbate the inflammatory response. So having optimal metabolic health in terms of low insulin, you know, low glycemic variability, low glucose overall, and just optimizing your cardiometabolic biomarkers is the way to combat this disease. And it's not, there's not a whole lot of attention, funding and resources being put into that right now.
All right, so there's two different arguments. There's body positivity, and I love that, and I want people to feel good and like you are where you are, and I don't think people should waste time beating themselves up unless it's useful to them as like a minor little kickstart to get things moving, but that's complicated, we'll set that aside. So I don't want people to shame themselves and all that. But at the same time, if you are more likely to die, suffer negative outcomes, then it's something that we, at least from an information standpoint, want to make sure that people understand so that they can take control and get whatever outcome they desire. So if people were to steer by the easy visual outcome of fat, are they going to be moving in the right direction? Or is it really true that you can be carrying excess body fat and still be completely healthy?
Yes, that's true. And I think what we need to sort of look at is objective biomarkers of metabolic health. If in the context of low blood pressure, you know, low fasting blood glucose, low insulin, low high sensitivity C-reactive protein, low hemoglobin A1C, optimal, you know, low triglycerides. So that's just some of the biomarkers that if
and are
they
those
are
mostly dancing around inflammation, is that really what we're trying to keep down?
What I just described were cardiometabolic biomarkers. And I think the best snapshot of your overall health and well-being and your ultimately your longevity will rely just upon like maybe 6 to 10, you know, objective biomarkers that we can easily measure even at home. There's like
can
kits that we use.
Can you walk through them slowly-ish?
Okay.
Like I've actually longed for this answer, but people always, it's like so much heady shit and I can't track it. Like, what are those?
Yeah, well, our conversation, you know, prior to getting on the show here was talking about continuous glucose monitoring. So that is a technology maybe everyone, not at this time, can afford, but it's probably the most important metabolic biomarker that we can track and should keep control of. So you can
do... So anybody that doesn't know glucose, sugar, right? Could come in the form of carbohydrate.
Yeah.
It's not always going to say sugar on the package, but your body turns that into glucose, which is essentially sugar in your bloodstream.
Yeah. And the lower, the better. So...
Why?
Why? Because, well, if your fasting blood glucose or say average glycemia that you can measure, directly measure with continuous glucose monitor, the correlate to that indirect would be hemoglobin A1C. And if you're above 6.5, you're diabetic.
And that's basically how much sugar has bound to your, I forget which cell?
Glycated hemoglobin, red blood cell.
Okay, so red blood cells have sticky sugar molecules stuck to them and they become inefficient, or are they actually at that point problematic?
Well, it's just, it is a correlate to the level of glycemia that you have in your body. And we know that proteins getting glycated, that's not a good thing. But the important thing is that if your inflammation markers, and a global marker would be C-reactive protein or high-sensitive C-reactive protein, which can measure in that low range. So if your immune system becomes activated, for example, if you have an intestinal bug, like a gastroenteritis, whether bacterial or viral, and I've seen this before in myself and traveling and getting like a little stomach bug, hsCRP goes through the roof. And this kind of results, you know, the etiology of all this is in the gut, right? So if your gut lining becomes compromised in any way through a virus or bacterial or something that you eat, then that triggers inflammation. And I've gotten like a stomach bug, you know, maybe two or three times in the last 10 years. And I quickly do a whole cardiometabolic blood work profile. And
just to see what's happening.
Just to see what's happening, because, and it's been very insightful and basically showing that your immune system really goes haywire if there's any kind of perturbation in the intestinal mucosa. And that can trigger permeability of the blood-brain barrier, and that can be neurotoxic. I mean, if you want to put a term to it, because, and this can happen if you have, Epstein-Barr virus, herpes simplex virus, various cytomegalovirus. So if they get shingles, for example, it'll start off with a headache. And one way to avoid it being exacerbated is to just go into a fast or go into a ketogenic state right there. And if your gut is compromised and your blood-brain barrier is compromised and you're introducing food, there's a lot of toxins in the food that we're eating, you know,
whether just it be plant, as a normal
no matter what
of
kind of diet you're eating. And even drinking water. So that becomes an additional challenge. And our immune system is kind of like an army, and there's only so much of a reserve that the army can have. But if you are under a chronically inflammatory state, then that army is occupied. And when you introduce things into the body, then there's very little reserve to deal with what's going on. If you're in a restricted diet, like an elimination diet, or if you're fasting, then you have all those reserves. Like your immune system is hypervigilant against whatever is coming into your body, because it's not dealing with the it's not trying to detoxify, your liver's not working, everything is sort of hypervigilant to be able to deal with, you know, the toxin. Mm-hmm. So, and your blood-brain barrier is less compromised too in that context. So I think when we're in these vulnerable states, when we're dealing with an infection, when we're dealing with whether it be like herpes simplex virus or shingles or cytomegalovirus or a variety of different chronic sort of viral diseases or bacterial, like Lyme's disease too, is a big one. And I think the etiology of many neurodegenerative diseases is actually a pathogen. And if you look at people with Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative diseases, you find the Borrelia bacteria within the brain, and many of them test positive for Lyme's disease. So it's a very controversial topic, and I think it needs to be studied more. The testing for Lyme's disease needs to be studied more, because it can go dormant, and then you're basically, it shows that you're not have an active, you know, disease process. But in the context of many pathogens, whether it be viral, whether it be bacterial, or if you are dealing with an inflammatory issue, fasting and a ketogenic diet, which mimics many aspects of fasting, can be very beneficial.
Okay, so that part I don't understand. So I've got a chronic virus. Does it apply to COVID as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think. I've got a chronic virus, could be COVID, could be herpes, could be whatever. Mm-hmm. And now my immune system is going crazy. It's trying to deal with that. Then I eat and I introduce more bacteria, more viruses, more things that are problematic, whatever those might be. So that I fully understand. But why, if the real issue is the breakdown of the lining of my gut, which allows something into my bloodstream, which then triggers my immune, which then breaks down the barrier in my brain, which then allows toxins into my brain, why would a diet or taking exogenous ketones, something that mimics a fasted state, still be useful? Because my immune system's still occupied and I've still introduced something problematic. So what is it about the fasting mimicking protocol that allows my immune system to be useful? Yeah.
So there's multiple things going on. One is that it's you are clearing various things in the blood that could be perceived as a toxin, an antigen, that would otherwise occupy your immune system. So this idea of your immune system being like an army and there's limited reserves to that army. When you're in a fasted state, the gut is always regenerating with stem cells. So during a fasting period, it can actually increase the production of stem cells. So you're actually making the intestinal mucosa, and then by connection with the intestinal mucosa, the tight junctions, that becomes a more firm barrier function. Inside, we have an open tube from our mouth to our anus, and that's that's continuous exposure to the environment. And the more impermeable we make that barrier function, the better our immune system is going to be. We have 70 to 80% of our immune system is in our gut. So
I get it on the fasting. What I don't understand, though, is why I'm assuming taking exogenous ketones, something that gives me
that
a sort
help.
Of mimicked.
Yeah.
But why? Why does that work?
Well, if you're on a ketogenic diet or taking exogenous ketones, that is... that can deal with a number of gut issues, that gut dysbiosis that could contribute to a breakdown of the intestinal mucosa and then the tight junctions. For example, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO, typically a consequence of a high carb diet, processed food, going fasting, or there's research now looking at exogenous ketones and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We know that a carbohydrate restricted diet, elimination diet can help in that regard. It goes back to this, the health of your gut will dictate, since your immune system is intimately linked to your gut, it will overall boost your immune system because there's less, challenges for your immune system.
I realize that exogenous ketones help with the junctions.
Yeah, that research is ongoing, but there's so many other things. So just prior to coming on here, I looked, I went to clinicaltrials.gov and I put in exogenous ketones to see what new clinical trials, and 96 clinical trials came up. The last time I was here, it might've been a dozen, but there's 96 clinical trials looking at ketone supplementation. From most of it was like cardiovascular disease. There was cognitive cancer. There was like probably a couple dozen with cancer looking into that. COVID-19, COPD, cystic fibrosis.
What are people
that's just a disease.
What are people are, what are they hoping is the mechanism at play with ketones? Obviously it's a guess. This is early trials. I'm just curious if there's one sort of central thesis about what ketones are doing. So like I had never heard the gut junction before. You're very clear it's ongoing.
Yeah.
But is there something, is it stimulating stem cells? I'm making this shit up. I'm just curious though, like what people are hoping or guessing at.
Well, we know that certain metabolic markers are improved with exogenous ketones. So they're being tested for type 2 diabetes right now, even type 1 diabetes. I was interested to see that. So if your metabolic markers are improving, if glycemia is going down and being more stable, if it's targeting various inflammatory pathways, we know that that's beneficial. So improving cardiometabolic health biomarkers, that's one way. But we also know that the ketone bodies, beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate, they're signaling molecules. They are hormones in the body. And then
how do those get created on a ketogenic diet?
So on a ketogenic diet, we experience hyperketonemia directly proportional to fatty acid oxidation in the liver. So that triggers a process called ketogenesis. And fatty acid oxidation contributes to the production of acetyl-CoA, and then that can condense and form acetoacetate, and then beta-hydroxybutyrate, which then enters circulation. And beta-hydroxybutyrate is the main circulatory ketone or ketone in circulation, and it's usually in about a 4-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio with acetoacetate.
So just to really simplify, are these all metabolites of fat metabolism?
They are. So I think of, you know, when we start fasting or we go on a ketogenic diet, glucose goes down. Mm-hmm. If we're, say, fasting because it's easier, glucose goes down, glucose availability to the brain becomes limited. So we liberate fat from our adipose tissue, and that through beta oxidation of fatty acids in the liver, it takes long water insoluble fat molecules and chops them up like a wood chipper.
In an enzymatic process?
It's an enzymatic process where you break down fatty, like beta oxidation of fatty acids is sort of a metabolic enzymatic process. And the breakdown products of fat are beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetoacetate, and they're water-soluble fat molecules that then readily enter circulation, and they can cross, the benefit is that they can cross membranes through the monocarboxylic acid transporter and the blood-brain barrier, so they can freely get into cells and stimulate, you know, energetic metabolism from the level of the mitochondria, and they do it better than glucose, and we can explain why if we can talk about, you know, the glucose, the GLUT3 transporter, pyruvate dehydrogenase, you know, complex.
I'm trying to like keep this shit grounded here, Dom. Very complicated.
There are many diseases where there's glucose impairment and the ketones can bypass those enzymatic, you know, rate limiting enzymes like PDH complex or transporters, which would be the glucose 3 transporter in the brain, if we're just talking about the brain. So if we consume exogenous ketones, then we put that right into circulation. But going back to, you asked about ketone production in the body. So, you know, ketone production directly correlates with suppression of insulin and insulin signaling. And that then contributes to a higher fatty acid oxidation, not only in the muscle, but also in the liver. Mm. And then accelerated fat oxidation, which never occurs with a standard American diet or a normal diet that people follow.
Because it has carbohydrates, sugar, tons of glucose.
A little bit of carbohydrates can really shut this process off. So that's why if your ketones are elevated even a little bit, that basically shows that you are oxidizing far more fat than 99% of the population. That's why ketones are an excellent biomarker or indicator of your fatty acid oxidation state. So breath ketones are probably more important because beta-hydroxybutyrate, when we're making it in the liver and it gets in circulation, it can give our brain energy and has anti-inflammatory effects and functions as a hormone, but it's being used for energy. So if we're sitting here in a fasted state and my ketones are 5 and I go for a quick walk around here, I could drop it down to 1 or 2 because the body's using that as a source of energy. Whereas your breath acetone is a really, really accurate indicator of your fatty acid oxidation state because we're blowing it off. It's not really being used as fuel. And it becomes a really important biomarker if you want to track your fat burning state. So right, probably more important than beta-hydroxybutyrate. And the breath acetone device I gave you, the Biosense device, is probably, it's an FDA approved device, is probably the best device out there for that. And it becomes really important tool that one can use for fasting if burning fat
to see if you're actually getting into ketosis.
Yeah. Like if that's, you know, the ranges are from 0 to 40. And if you're at 30 or 40, I mean, your fat metabolism is maxed out. Whereas if beta hydroxybutyrate, if you're pretty active and you're using beta hydroxybutyrate as fuel and you're concerned because you're not getting above 1 or you're like at 0.5 or 1, that could be, you could be a good ketone producer, but a super ketone utilizer because your tissues is sucking up
that fuel. How do you tell the difference then between whether you're just really good at making and using or you're just not good at making?
Yeah, well, something that I thought of, I called it, I kind of termed this, made this term ketone tolerance test. So there's a glucose tolerance test where you consume glucose and you look at the profile of glycemia over time. And the faster it goes down, the better More insulin sensitive you are, and the better glucose
metabolism. Meaning you pull the sugar out of the bloodstream, put it into cells,
yeah,
fat
yeah.
cells, essentially.
So athletes are, you know, really quick. They'll sort of, and if you're in a fasted state, you know, if you ate a lot of carbs the day before, your liver glycogen could be topped off. But if you're like in a normal state and you consume a massive bolus of glucose and you clear it from your blood, that's a good thing. Mm. So with ketones, we find that athletes will dispose of the ketones faster too. So if you consume ketones and you clear it from your blood really fast, which athletes do, then that's what we call like a ketone tolerance test. And if you don't clear the ketones from your blood, if you're a sedentary person, this is more likely to happen. So the ketones circulate around a while and it takes a while to clear it from your blood. But the more metabolically fit you are and the higher metabolic flexibility, the more fat adapted or keto adapted you are, the faster you're going to clear ketones from your blood. So this is important for people that are pricking their finger and measuring beta hydroxybutyrate, because many athletes that I communicate with, they're like, they can't get above like 0.5 or even, you know, one in a fasted state. But if they blow into a breath acetone monitor, like a Biosense, they see their breath acetone is like off the charts, and that would correlate very well with their fat oxidation state. Whereas the beta hydroxybutyrate is underrepresented because they are such a fine-tuned machine, their bodies are using the ketones for fuel, and your brain's using it for fuel too.
Okay, so that all makes sense. Now, I'm still trying to hunt down this idea that taking exogenous ketones, because I understand why the mechanism works from a fasting standpoint. Mm-hmm. Taking exogenous ketones, if you were testing all of my meaningful markers for mm-hmm. ketosis,
yeah.
would you be able to tell the difference between, like, if I lied to you and I said, oh, Dom, I've been fasting for 3 days, and you take my blood readings, could you tell this motherfucker's lying? He obviously took exogenous ketones, because we're reading it in his blood, but yeah. there are also these other markers. Because
yeah.
that's where I'm like, does adding something in, if I'm already doing all the damage,
yeah.
is there something really that magical about ketones where my body's like, whoa, if there are ketones present, then do all yeah. this stuff, because it means, you know, whatever from an evolutionary standpoint.
Yeah. So the question, I mean, maybe stated a little bit differently, because I want to answer it the right way, is that if you don't follow a ketogenic diet, if you follow any diet, standard American diet, and you add ketones, is that giving you any meaningful benefit?
Yes.
Maybe. So you can kind of hack the system and consume exogenous ketones. And that was the whole idea behind our research, because we pitched the idea of a ketogenic diet to the Department of Defense Office of Navy Research. They didn't like the idea of changing the diet, and they wanted a ketogenic diet and a drug for the anti-seizure effects. And this makes sense, because the clinical application of the ketogenic diet, the origin of the ketogenic diet is 100 years ago, and that was for seizures. So it made sense that if you induce rapidly a state of hyperketonemia, then the ketones, we know, provide energy, make the brain more resilient, and then it also activates anti-seizure pathways, like it elevates GABA, you know, reduces glutamate signaling and inflammation too. So the same, and that's in the context of seizures. So the ketones, think about it like in the evolutionary context, if we're fasting and ketones are elevated, that beta hydroxybutyrate becomes a very high amplitude signal to tell the rest of our body that we are in a fasted state. So it just jumps out. If you do like a full metabolomic profile of all the things popping out, beta hydroxybutyrate comes up really high. And that was actually the motivation for one of the studies that was done at Yale, looking at fasting and the anti-inflammatory effects of fasting. If they took a metabolomic profile of the animals or humans, beta-hydroxybutyrate is way above everything else. So this idea, which resulted in a study and a publication in Nature Medicine, looked at beta-hydroxybutyrate as an inhibitor of the NLRP3 inflammasome, which when activated elevates IL-1 beta and other inflammatory markers. So beta-hydroxybutyrate, independent of a dietary intervention, suppressed the activation of this NLRP3 inflammasome and then the downstream cytokine cascade, independent of changing diet. So it's an endogenous metabolite that your body makes that you can consume exogenously that's functioning like a hormone. And it also, for reasons we don't fully understand, it decreases our blood glucose significantly. And that has major implications for type 2 diabetes and
major implications for a lot.
A lot of things, yeah.
All right, so that's super crazy. So now I'm gonna guess at what they're testing, and you may or may not know this, but what they're testing, because you said that COVID was one of the things they were looking at from an exogenous ketone test
and ketogenic diet too.
Ketogenic diet, though, I understand why that would work. The ketones, are they asking the question of, hey, as a signaling molecule that dampens the inflammatory response, knowing that a cytokine storm is one of the things that kills people with comorbidities with COVID, could we use this to essentially calm the immune system?
Yeah, so that's the idea, is that if you improve metabolic biomarkers and you consume exogenous ketones, by putting your body in a lower inflammatory state, it then makes the immune system hypervigilant to deal with any other challenge. We just published a study last week on chronic obstructive pulmonary disease that was a case report. So an individual, he goes by the name of COPD athlete, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease has no cure. I mean, it's like a death sentence. It's irreversible hardening of the actual lung tissue itself, where the elasticity of the lung and the pliability of the lung goes down. So in this context, an athlete reached out to me, and he goes by the name of COPD athlete, and now he's more or less like an influencer that was experimenting on things, including a ketogenic diet, and then he added exogenous ketones. And we collected data on him over the years and just got it published, a case report showing that he actually got back lung function. FEV1, which is like a measurement of your lung function, actually improved over time. So this is really unheard of in COPD patients. So this was basically producing hyperketonemia with a ketogenic diet, but then later he added exogenous ketones and was using it running marathons, running races and things like that. So, and now I saw, I didn't get to look into it, but just before coming here, I saw cystic fibrosis. So exogenous ketones were in a clinical trial right now with cystic fibrosis, and that was pretty interesting. And it had to do with lowering inflammatory markers to improve lung function.
Dude?
Yeah.
This is so interesting. So I have a growing hypothesis. I'm a layperson, so take it for what it's worth. But I have a growing hypothesis that just an absolute overwhelming number of the issues that we face as sort of chronic illness, things that we think of as being genetic issues, are basically we're doing things that agitate our immune system, and it's the prolonged overactivity of the immune system that's really the problem. And so anything that lowers that. So going back to that key insight that you gave me at the beginning, that basically you get an insult to the immune system, whatever that may be, and then you eat something on top of that that carries pathogens or whatever. And so you, and then if on top of that, you're also just your standard American diet, which is highly inflammatory from the amount of glucose that it contains, that we're just constantly agitating the immune system, agitating. And when I now put it into an evolutionary context, and I'm gonna do something that may make you deeply uncomfortable as somebody who really understands science, but I find it incredibly useful to get a sense of what the bumpers in the bowling alley are. I'm gonna create a narrative that I can sort of make these dots connect. So if I think about health from an evolutionary standpoint, and I think about what fasting would be, because from an evolutionary standpoint, fasting is, hey, motherfucker, you're about to die. You better eat something. And if in those moments, things get worse and it's harder to move, harder to think, harder to see, all of that, I'm fucked. And so evolution has, over this extraordinarily long period of time, has selected for people that have it's not superhuman, but like this, everything improves by slipping into this, yo, you're actually in kind of a dangerous state. Food has obviously become scarce. I need you hypervigilant. I need you focused. But I'm not, the immune system is going to chill out because I can't have all my resources going to that, which then reduces inflammation, makes your joints feel better. You can think more clearly. You don't have headaches, on and on and on. Does that narrative, though not proven out, make sense?
Yeah, from an evolutionary perspective. So, I mean, I believe evolution was God's tool for creation. So there's a big debate between science and religion. And I think a lot of the debate really is centered around evolution, and there's creative evolution or intelligent design that people talk about. But many of the upper level scientists sort of believe, as they advance in their knowledge about biochemistry and life and creative evolution, is that evolution, although there's not hard evidence for this, but being devout Christians, they believe that they've come to the consensus upon studying all the philosophy, all the religion, all the and very deep levels of science, that creation, that evolution is sort of God's tool for creation. And our concept of God can be highly variable even in the same religion, right? Mm. So, but bringing it back to fasting, I think that going in, being in a fasted state, there's an evolutionary advantage, evolution being a tool of God, that can create hypervigilance in cognition, hypervigilance in your immune system, and performance enhancements.
Wouldn't it almost have to be the opposite, that the immune system chills out?
Well, your immune system becomes more powerful and hypervigilant because it's not dealing with other pathogens or antigens that you've introduced through your diet.
It seems very different to me. So I don't want to derail you, but I think this is important enough to stop on. So you've got, you get a virus from the outside. You walked us through, the immune system goes crazy.
Yep.
So,
A good thing. The immune response and the inflammation is a very beneficial thing, because it's like working out, right? If you do an extremely hard workout and then you take blood, you should, and you had someone looking at you, they would basically say, stop doing what you just did. it's the adaptive response to that stimuli, which is very good. So when you fast, there's an adaptive response that can further augment fatty acid oxidation in the liver. Your liver becomes better at ketogenesis. So there's an upregulation of ketogenesis. There's an upregulation of ketolytic enzymes that allow your body to use the ketones for fuel. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And you become a much more efficient ketone producer and ketone utilizer when you fast. So this is this augmented response is in response to a stimulus. The same thing with your immune system. The augmented response, and if you take the peak of the response, that's when you are adapting, not the nadir. The nadir is when you become hypervigilant to be able to detect various antigens that you're putting in your body, and then your body is already adapted and augmented in a way to deal with that challenge. So it's like, you know, you wouldn't go into a max effort lift if you just did your max effort lift the day before, right? You want your body to recover and heal, and then you are much more able to recruit the contractile apparatus to move the weight.
So what makes the immune system overreact then? Because I think of my story was the immune system gets some insult, whether it's a virus, whether it's the food that you eat, whatever, it gets that insult and you get inflammation. And so if inflammation is useful, but ultimately has a problematic side.
Acute inflammation is like super useful. So think about acute inflammation as like working out, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a stimulus, you have damage, and then the adaptive response.
So but this cytokine storm that kills people with COVID, that is due to the chronic nature of the virus? That doesn't seem to make sense. Or you're saying because, hey, the reason that it's only problematic in people that have comorbidities is because they've already had this chronic problem. That actually makes a lot of sense. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, COVID is a little different. You can have your, if you're, that's why healthy young people, it's very, potentially very damaging for them, because a very large immune response could cause more damage to your internal organs. So if your immune system is, my term of hypervigilant is being able to detect something, deal with it, and neutralize it.
Okay.
So that's hypervigilance, without overreacting. So that's a proper immune response. Whereas if you have an autoimmune condition, under no situations that I'm aware of are autoantibodies beneficial. Maybe they are. I don't know. From my knowledge, you know, about the immune system, immunology, in no context are autoantibodies a good thing. If you have an autoimmune...
Meaning your body reacting to itself?
So antibodies against itself, against proteins that are in itself. And I mean, we all have some degree of autoantibodies, but under, I don't know of any benefit to autoantibodies. So some people have more than others, but there are a host of people who have autoimmune disorders. And in the context of an autoimmune disorder, your immune system is sort of compromised and it's hypovigilant. So it's not able to augment your immune system in a way until the situation becomes very dire. So, and in that context, when you launch a massive immune response, then you're just like dire straits. In an autoimmune condition, your immune system is chronically activated.
So now it's just worn thin, it's fucking exhausted. So
yeah, you
it
kind of
underreacts
it,
like, until it's dire and then it goes crazy.
Yeah. So that's not all situations are that scenario, but I think that's a good approximation or overview of kind of what's happening.
Okay, so now help me understand, because that all fits this narrative that I'm telling myself. Mm-hmm. But the young, healthy people having such a robust immune system that they overreact, that's the one. Do you think that's just something that has to do with that this is a virus we've never seen before and so we're not adapted to deal with it? And so it just causes a sort of glitch in the matrix, or?
Yeah, the pathogenicity is like super, it's like hyper pathogenic in that way that it can sort of hijack your immune system. And when you have a massive cytokine storm and it can attack your internal organs, your heart, your brain, your liver, your kidneys. And if we had type 2 diabetes or we have comorbidities on top of that, then our system is weakened. And that's why we are much more susceptible if we're older, if we have type 2 diabetes, obesity, that scenario. But in healthy young people, and this is, you know, I'm not a COVID researcher, but from my understanding is, you know, that's these long haulers do get damaged to internal organs like the heart, and then they have to deal with it, you know, over time, and it becomes more of a
it can become
a chronic condition.
Is there a way to unwind that stuff?
Well, yeah, the heart can repair itself to some extent, the liver can too, but kidneys not as much. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be a fallout from young people that are perfectly metabolically healthy getting this disorder, getting this condition. So that I don't know what, you know, the outcome's going to be. But I've getting a lot of emails from people, young, healthy people that have gotten COVID, and now they have, and personal friends of mine too have had it. There are no clinics dealing with long COVID, dealing with the host of things that come after dealing with this disease, even though they're not positive for COVID, the damage that they have is not easily undone. So there's going to be, it's going to open up a whole nother market, I think, of clinics that treat people who've had COVID that need to specialize in that, you know, these situations. And every condition is kind of unique. So you're going to have need a diverse array of people, like, you know, a cardiologist, a pulmonologist, you know, a renal physiologist. I believe that that's going to be the scenario that we're going to be faced with, that there are many people looking for help and the doctors can't help them. And then we need to develop specialized clinics. But if we focus on metabolic health now, that's something we can do now.
All right. So I mean, give me the, like, what's the straightforward things that people should be doing to optimize metabolic health?
Yeah. Well, I think glycemia is probably the most important biomarker that we can track.
Keep your blood sugar low.
Yeah. So, and you can measure fasting blood glucose. And then if you wear a continuous glucose monitor, you are basically seeing a video. So if I want to study a cheetah, I could look at a picture of a cheetah running, or I can watch a video of a cheetah running. I'm going to get a lot more information out of the video of the cheetah running, right? So that's what a continuous glucose monitor is giving you, that real-time information.
Because there's so much variability, individual variability, we have to do it all for ourselves.
Understanding the variability is far more important than looking at a snapshot of fasting.
But I mean from person to person. So instead of you just saying, go eat red meat or go eat broccoli, it's everybody has to get the optimal results. People should test the stuff for themselves because they're going to react differently than somebody else eating the same exact thing.
That's very, very true. So, and people have different physiological responses to that. So I thrive off a low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, and my glycemia is typically maintained between 110 and 60. Right. So I rarely get out of that scenario,
and
I feel great. So a lot of people ask me about the carnivore diet or plant-based diet. So the carnivore diet, from my opinion, is a diet that can sustain life. A vegan diet can sustain life, but it's not optimal. I think we are, from an evolutionary perspective, from that we are omnivores, right? Mm. So we are basically hardwired and evolved to eat, to be extremely adaptable in what we are eating.
So what do you think when you look at...
We become less adaptable if we're eating carnivore, and less adaptable
less
is
adaptable
bad.
Less adaptable if we're eating carnivore?
If for long-term carnivore adherence, a carnivore diet is okay to use intermittently for different things, but if you are eating meat and only meat, then you become, and you go back to eating dairy or plants or something like this, you're going to have an immune response. I think it's good to introduce a variety of foods. And if you are following carnivore, it's good to get a rainbow of different meats, right? So from pork to beef, to liver, to chicken, to fish. And I think that's important, not just a steak every day. And I think the carnivore diet is a useful diet for weight loss. To some extent, it's like hypo-palatable and hyper-satiating. And I think it reduces our hedonic response to food. Like, that's why the ketogenic diet is so powerful. For weight loss, it's like, you know, you did 4-to-1 ketogenic diet. You can tell it's hyper satiating and hypopalatable. You're not going to overeat.
It's gross.
Gain weight. Yeah, it's gross.
And so, yeah.
So the utility there is that it becomes a means for calorie restriction, right? So if we calorie restrict a carb-based processed food diet, we're going to get benefits. Probably not as much benefits as a ketogenic diet or carnivore diet. But the utility of a carnivore diet as a weight loss tool is that your glycemia is controlled and it promotes, I'm not going to say healthy weight loss, but weight loss over time. And I use it from time to time. I don't do like a carnivore, months of carnivore, but I'll do a couple carnivore days where I just eat meat and that's it, or just eggs or something.
Is it because there are nutrients in vegetables that you think that we need, or?
Well, actually, that's a good point and a good question. So a carnivore diet, especially if you have organ meat, is super, super high in nutrition. And if you are getting surplus amount of calories on a carnivore diet, especially with organ meat, then you can have hypervitaminosis. There's so many vitamins, like from B12 to vitamin A and other things, that blood work can actually show you're out of normal range. So a carnivore diet, especially with organ meat, is really, really good in the context of a calorie deficit. So if you're on a very limited amount of calories and you want to get as much nutrition as possible with the least amount of calories, a carnivore diet is the perfect approach. And that could be, I mean, that explains like the majority of people out there. So I think in that context, the carnivore diet could be the ideal diet for the majority of people. And once you lose the weight and get your ideal weight, then you could introduce more of a omnivorous diet. And fiber is really important, I believe, from getting plants into the diet. And I think that's...
Why is that important?
For the diversity of your gut microbiome, also for digestion. If you have, if I eat a steak, I like to have it with a salad or broccoli or something like that. The fiber actually attenuates the rise in glycemia and the insulin response. So it helps slow protein digestion and decrease gastric absorption, the fiber does. So there's benefits there just from the process, from the way your body processes protein. So that's a benefit for adding fiber. So, and we see that with a ketogenic diet, when we add vegetables in the form of non-glycemic fiber, that attenuates the rise in glucose, and which would be minimal anyway, but also the release of insulin. So the release of insulin is intimately linked to various nutrients entering circulation. And with the ketogenic diet or carnivore, that would be like the branched chain amino acids like leucine and other amino acids would trigger an insulin response. So we can attenuate that and improve our overall metabolic health just by adding fiber. And then the fiber, the diversity of the fiber we're giving will reflect in the diversity of the gut microbiome. And another recent study came out about fermented foods. So what may even be more important than having a diversity of fiber is actually having fermented foods can contribute to the population, can reverse gut dysbiosis and increase the diversity of the gut microbiome.
And this stuff is so fascinating and so complex. Let me ask a pointed question. So is a calorie...
It doesn't have to be, though. I think it's super simple. But I think the science can be complex. But when it comes
what's
to
super simple,
actionable things that people can do, yeah, it's pretty simple.
Say it in a sentence.
Pretty much carbohydrate restriction, like some level, based in relation to what we're being advised from a USDA perspective, reducing carbohydrates and replacing grains and sugars with vegetables, so non-glycemic vegetables, and keeping our protein moderate and keeping our fat, you know, relatively high, I think is a good thing for the majority of people. But some people, like my wife, were coming here. She had, you know, two sugary muffins for breakfast, and she thrives off that. Although when we're coming here, she did say, "Do you think they have food? I'm getting kind of hungry." So I never get hungry.
Now I feel terrible because we didn't offer her food when she came.
No,
and yes,
we
have plenty.
Understand all the regulations
of
COVID.
So,
but I mean, the point is that if you can thrive off a carbohydrate-based diet, but your glycemic variability will correlate to food cravings. So if you want to go throughout your day and have optimal productivity and feel optimal energy, I've found, as many other people do, that a low carb approach is the way to go. And it's probably due in part because you do not have postprandial dips in your blood glucose.
Is postprandial post eating?
Yeah. So when you eat carbohydrates, you know, for me, if I have carbs like a Pop-Tart within 60 to 90 minutes, I'm down to like 55 milligrams per deciliter.
What?
Yeah, so it might shoot up to 150, 160.
Do you come back glucose. Down that fast because you have muscle mass? Like, that's fast.
That's, well, yeah, you get an insulin response and then that triggers glucose disposal, the insulin, mm-hmm. and then I get another craving and it becomes a vicious cycle, and that pretty much explains, you know, the majority of the American population.
Yeah.
But you could effectively attenuate that or completely abolish that simply by carbohydrate restriction, a low carb ketogenic diet. It doesn't have to be ketogenic, it just could be low carb. You moderate it to like 50 to 100 grams a day and you're right on that edge of ketosis. But if you do a ketogenic diet, like we talked about, there are benefits to being in a hyper ketonemic state. So the ketones then act as an alternative energy source, anti-inflammatory molecule, and a hormone, which has many beneficial effects, even at the level of epigenetic. So it's an epigenetic modulator to produce adaptations to get you to have more benefits to being in a fasted or a ketogenic state. And we know that the ketone body, beta-hydroxybutyrate, can epigenetically modify the production of enzymes that allow you to burn fat more efficiently and make ketones more efficiently, and also transport ketones more efficiently, like the transporters. And then even at the level of the mitochondria, the ketolytic enzymes are also upregulated through ketone-induced epigenetic regulation. Mm. So this is like new science that's emerging. We've observed, you know, you observe people who fast and then they fast again and they get into a state of ketosis much quicker. So the basic science is basically pointing to the direction that the ketone metabolites itself, and this could also be true for lactate and other metabolites, activate genetic pathways and genes that can actually enhance enzymatic activity to make us more adaptable to the diet and to make it easier if we go into a fasted state. I think you got like the keto flu when you did the ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
So maybe if you transitioned into the ketogenic diet and consume exogenous ketones in small amounts, your liver was not making enough ketones to prevent glucose withdrawal in the brain. So mm-hmm. that's part of it, but also your electrolytes were probably off and things like that. A ketone salt product supplies ketones and electrolytes, so it kind of hits two birds with one stone.
That's interesting.
So that could be like
Do
a
they
way
have
around
calories?
It. Yeah, I don't think manufacturers put calories on there, but that's a good point because I don't think FDA, they don't need to do that. They're not, the regulations
are
such.
I asked because I did, the longest fast I've ever done was 5 days. And the last 2 days I was just non-functioning. It was,
Yeah. It
was like being sick. And that's after I am extraordinarily good at burning ketones. I was taking my ketone measurements all the time.
Yep.
I felt great in ketosis, a 24-hour fast, very easy, 48-hour fast, easy, 72 starts to get dicey.
Yeah.
By the fourth day, it just was, it was so deleterious to my business that I was like, I'm not doing a 5-day fast anymore, but I'm perfectly willing to accept there's just something I was doing wrong. I was water only, but I was taking pinches of salt every now and then. It was just gnarly.
Yes. Well, it's because you mentioned for day 4 and 5. So I've done a lot of fasts, and 72 hours is really the sweet spot for many different reasons. One thing is that I monitor the fast by my strength. If my strength starts to go down, that's a negative indicator, and also muscle mass. So I tend not to lose any strength or muscle mass if I do 72 hours, but 4 and 5 day fast or 1 week fast will lower my strength. And typically I feel it in the weeks after, a week or two after. So also, if we want to enhance our insulin resistance and maximize autophagy, I think that we should, a 72 hour fast, after about 48 hours for a healthy person, at 72 hours, we've gotten about 24 hours of a glucose ketone index of 1, which means your glucose comes down and your ketones come up to the millimolar concentration are about equal, about 3 millimolar each. And in that state, the level of insulin suppression and other things being suppressed can maximize autophagy. So at a 72-hour fast, you have about 24 hours of autophagy, and taking it beyond that, from my opinion, there's not going to be any benefits for a healthy person. If you're super insulin resistant and your insulin's like around, 10, 11, 12, that prolonging that to 4 and 5 or maybe even 1 week can help bring that down. And if you have a lot of weight to lose, then it's probably more beneficial to fast longer. But for the average person, 72 hours will give you all the benefits of fasting and reduce the negative consequences from the hormone to like your muscle strength, muscle function. So that's what I do personally. And I do it in a way that it's kind of like an oil change for your car, right? So it's fine-tuning your metabolic health to optimize your insulin sensitivity, and I also advocate for giving blood every 3 months to 4 months.
So just to force your body to replenish?
Well, it lowers your iron. So for males, they have high iron's a bad thing for longevity. So if you want to live longer, the one thing, there's 10 things that you could do, like off time, but giving blood is never really talked about. But I think giving blood is probably a super important thing to do if you're a male.
All right. So you're God. You create this evolutionary mechanism.
Yep.
By which you're going to create this cool creation called man.
Yeah.
Humans.
Yep.
And why on earth would you make it such that they have to give blood to maintain optimal iron levels? That seems super fishy.
No doubt, early man was bleeding a lot. So
you really think it comes down to that?
Yeah, I mean, they're slipping I walk around barefoot on my property and I cut my foot the other day and probably lost like a half pint of blood. So this was like normal.
Jesus. I mean, you cut it on?
I don't know, it's like a piece of metal or nail or something like that. But I mean, there's things, it's normal for, early ancestors to get injured, to lose blood, and we want to have a reserve in blood. Women don't have the reserve because they menstruate, unless they're postmenopausal.
That's so interesting.
But, high iron can drive something called the Fenton reaction and make a more oxidative state and just can be negative consequences for our longevity. And I think that's why women actually age better than men. And there's like a little bit of a gap there as far as longevity. And I think the iron thing could be part of that.
Wow.
But that's just one of many things. It's also good. It feels good to give blood. I mean, you're giving back, but there are many benefits to giving blood from the perspective of just reducing your iron. And then through the blood organization, they ping me every 3 to 4 months. Hey, it's time for you to give blood. So I give double red, which is double the amount of red blood cells. And it's made my hematocrit, which is on the high end of normal, to come back down to normal. And I think that's going to pay big dividends over time. Like having a normal to maybe even slightly low normal hematocrit over 10 years is going to give you a big advantage in longevity to the person that's elevated. The same thing with glycemia. So if your hemoglobin A1C or your average glucose is 100 and you can bring that down with a low carb diet to 85, you're not diabetic if it's 100, But, you know, you're not clinically diagnosed, but if you're able to bring that down to 85, that's going to add like 3 to 5 years to your life, I think, over time.
Wow.
Well, if you're like at 130 and you bring that down to like below 100, I think for sure that's going to probably add, you know, a couple years to your life. You know, that would be my estimate. So even though, you know, there's many people out there who do not have clinical diabetes, and there's no need for them from the medical establishment to wear a continuous glucose monitor or to be checking or these biomarkers, it's going to be super advantageous for them to be lower. So lower is always better, from lower insulin, lower glucose, lower glycemic variability. All these things are simple things that people can do to improve their metabolic health and their longevity.
I love it. Dude, talking to you is so much fun. Where can people follow you, see all your latest stuff?
Yeah, same spot, ketonutrition.org. And on social media, I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. So just search my name and find me through that. But Keto Nutrition, we have a blog, comes out every 2 times a month, and we have a newsletter. So sign up for that.
Love it. Guys, sign up. Trust me, dude. As you just saw, this guy's full of so much useful information, and usability is the ultimate thing that is the test of something's worthiness, in my opinion. And speaking of things that are usable and worthy, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. And until next time, my friends, be legendary. Take care. Thank you guys so much for watching and being a part of this community. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe. You're going to get weekly videos on building a growth mindset, cultivating grit, and unlocking your full potential.